picture is very mysterious. It shows a landscape, rather crudely painted when you look at it very closely, with one figure fleeing, another lying apparently dead on the floor, and a third on tiptoe carrying a child on top of a strange little hut. Also attached to the surface of the picture is a gate, a miniature gate, which presumably originally you could close, although it wouldn't quite fill the space between the gate itself and the hut, which makes it an irritant. And in the sky is this tiny, weeny nightingale threatening these people. The meaning? It has no realistic meaning. Like most surrealist works, it attempts to put a bucket down into the well of the unconscious and bring up whatever image the artist finds there, and to then realise it.
The work of surrealist artist Max Ernst stems from the deep, almost bottomless well of his unconscious mind. His paintings are fantastical creations, vivid, haunting, dreamlike, sometimes charged with menace, often loaded with irony. They fuse seemingly familiar objects or images in totally unfamiliar combinations and surroundings. And ultimately, as art historian Elizabeth Legg explains, they're unfathomable in terms of conventional meaning.
You can never know everything about these pictures, and he didn't intend you to. But he certainly tried, by setting the pictures up like that, to get you to think about the pictures. Not, perhaps, directing you toward coming up with one meaning, but to puzzle. That is one of Max Ernst's accomplishments. He makes you puzzle.
Ernst was born in 1891 in Rhineland, Germany, in the small town of Bruhl, in fact, which lies in the heavily forested region to the south of Cologne. His family were strict Catholics, against which Ernst was to rebel in later life. His father, who was a teacher of the deaf and dumb, seems to have been an imposing, even fearful figure of authority, particularly if the artist's childhood reminiscences are to be believed. Art historian Dawn Addis.
He seems to have had, in some ways, a rather troubled childhood. Certainly the way he talked about it later suggests that he was jealous of his father in classic Oedipal fashion. He talks about, as a very young child, seeing visions in the mahogany panel at the end of his bed. And these visions gathered themselves into the image of a threatening man with upturned moustaches, as Ernst said, the moustaches of my father. And this figure, which grew out of the panel at the end of his bed, then started whipping a top, which was made up of a number of vicious-looking animals. Now, obviously, one could interpret this as the father threatening the son. How far one can actually carry this into Ernst's actual childhood and say whether he was indeed oppressed by his father is difficult to say, but he felt that he was in some way, that he was very aware of a sort of conflict with his father.
Ironically, one of the sources of conflict was young Max's decision to take up painting. In this respect, he was following in the footsteps of his father, who was an accomplished amateur painter. But Ernst Sr. strongly disapproved of his son continuing to study painting, among other things, at university.
Max Ernst started to paint before the First World War a bit. He took some art courses at university, although mostly what he studied at university was, interestingly, philosophy and psychology. And then, of course, there was the intervening war, which really traumatized him, as it did most people of his generation. And he himself said of it,
"On the 1st of August 1914, Max Ernst died. He was resurrected on the 11th of November 1918, as a young man who aspired to find the myths of his time."
His search for the myths of his time began in Cologne, amidst the artistic chaos otherwise known as Dada. Dada was an ideology, loosely shared by artists and writers all over Europe, who sought ways of expressing their total disillusionment with European culture. And, as artist Conroy Maddox explains, always in as provocative and destructive a manner as possible.
The whole point of what the Dadaists were doing was to destroy the old concept of art as we know it. You know, permanency of pigment and permanency of everything, you know. They destroyed that. They were against Impressionism. They were against everything. So they were doing outrageous things deliberately. I mean, there was one marvellous exhibition in Cologne where the entrance was through a public lavatory and everyone was given a little axe to go in and destroy what they didn't like.
But even the anarchic events of Cologne Dada couldn't hold Ernst's interest for long, and in 1922 he moved to Paris. He'd long been fascinated by French culture, and immediately after the war he began to establish close contact with the Paris Dada group, particularly the poets Paul Éluard and André Breton, who were soon to become founder members of a coalition of artists and writers who proclaimed themselves to be surrealist. The surrealists were trying to discover ways of expressing the workings of the unconscious mind, primarily through automatic processes of writing and mark-making, which centred around losing conscious creative control. In other words, writing whatever came into their heads, or simply doodling in a trance-like state to see what could emerge. Ernst shared a fascination for the irrational with the French surrealists, and like them was often inspired by art produced by the clinically insane. But unlike his French colleagues, Ernst's German education had given him the opportunity to study extensively the work of Sigmund Freud, which gave him further insight into the realms of the unconscious. And so, psychoanalysis became a central part of Ernst's artistic practice in Paris.
I think the reason it was important to him was that he was not really spontaneously an automatist artist in the way the surrealists envisioned a visual artist should be. There is a story that he picked up Miró at one point and sort of shook him up and down because Maxence was a very tall man and Miró was a very tiny man, and said, "How do you do it? How do you do it?" wanting to know how Miró managed to produce these extraordinary automatist images. I think reading Freud's descriptions of dreams and the unconscious enabled Max Ernst to make pictures that had to do with the unconscious, although he himself couldn't really go into hypnotic trances or be automatist right off the top of his head.
Which of his paintings are the most important psychoanalytically, or which show us Max Ernst as a psychoanalyzing artist most clearly?
I think the painting that has been most often interpreted that way is a painting he did in 1923 that was very important to the rest of the surrealists too, called Pietà, or Revolution by Night.
This picture has two titles. It's either called Pietà, which was the title usually given by the old masters to the Virgin Mary holding the dead Christ, or it's called The Revolution, The Night. What it shows, like the traditional Pietà, is one figure holding another in its arms, but they're not the Virgin and the Christ. They are a bowler-hatted man with a moustache, holding in his arms a creature wearing red trousers, white socks, a white coat, and having a grey face, which is drawn in only in a linear sense. It's hardly modelled, and seems to be that of a classical statue. And behind these figures, which occupy the foreground, is a kind of balcony and something rather like a shower nozzle on one side of it. And then behind that, drawn on the wall at the top of some steps, is another bearded figure with its eyes shut. And again, of course, people tend to say, what does it represent? It's very difficult exactly to define that. But one has to note that Ernst's father, who was a very pious Catholic person, had cursed Ernst and sent him off, saying that he never wished to see him again. "My curse go with you," he shouted. And I have a feeling that the bowler-hatted figure might represent the father here.
He sits himself, rigid and upright, in his father's arms, looking both dead and alert at the same time. It's very disconcerting in that way. And it's usually been interpreted in terms of the Oedipus complex, the son who harbors, you know, incestuous desires for the mother, being punished by the father in some way. And I also think in that painting, another element of the way Max Ernst has represented himself as dead, but sitting bolt upright with his arms and legs held very rigidly, is actually very close to illustrations of pictures of the insane that he would have seen in medical textbooks, particularly catatonics. And I think it's not just a negative image in that sense of punishment. He's also, in a way, asserting himself, dead though he may be, in terms of the Oedipus complex, as possessing the kind of visionary and creative powers that he associated with the insane.
Equally important for Ernst was the picture-making process known as collage. By cutting out images from newspapers and magazines and reorganizing them in unexpected combinations, he discovered a whole new world of possibilities.
My excited gaze is provoked by the pages of a printed catalogue. The advertisements illustrate objects relating to anthropological, microscopical, psychological, mineralogical, and paleontological research. Here I discover the elements of a figuration so remote that its very absurdity provokes in me a sudden intensification of my faculties of sight, a hallucinatory succession of contradictory images, double, triple, multiple, superimposed upon each other with the persistence and rapidity characteristic of amorous memories and visions of somnolence. These images, in turn, provoke new planes of understanding.
And these new planes of understanding and the process of collage were in turn transformed into powerful, almost dreamlike paintings.
This picture, which is called The Elephant of Salivaz, is one of the great masterpieces of Ernst's early work. It's a large canvas, and the elephant itself is a mechanical object, really. Some people say that Ernst saw a photograph of an African grain bin, which forms the main body. The elephant has a kind of bull's face, more than an elephant. It has horns like a bull. And then an enormous double tube comes where the trunk would come and vanishes into a hole in the top part of the elephant. And above it is a kind of mechanical howdah. That's what you used to sit in elephants. It has a melancholy look to it. However, it is beckoned by a nude woman without a head, but wearing a red glove, and she is beckoning it out of the canvas.
Most people have tried to interpret those, I think, directly in a Freudian way, you know, the woman as object, because, you know, the head's chopped off, so therefore what you're left is the woman's body, the map of the body, the erogenous map, if you like. I think that's too simplistic a reading of them. I think they are tied up with both religion, tied into the abnormal psychology he became interested in. But more than that, I think there's a sort of overlay of the occult there. He kept calling himself a magician. The borders between what was the occult and what was really the beginnings of dynamic psychiatry are very blurred. Remember, Freud was thought of as an occult sort of thinker in the 1890s and the first part of this century.
Ernst scholar Mark Gisborne. Ernst's work in the 1920s and 30s is marked by a capacity to explore and almost reinvent his artistic practice. And it's this, according to Conroy Maddox, that adds considerable weight to his reputation.
Ernst has always been known as the complete surrealist because he explored so many avenues, especially automatic processes. Frottage is one.
At an inn by the seaside, I'm impressed by the obsession imposed upon my excited gaze by the wooden floor, the grain of which had been deepened and exposed by countless scrubbings. I decide to investigate the symbolism of this obsession, and to aid my meditative and hallucinatory powers, I take from the boards a series of drawings.
Well, what I've got here is a piece of paper. It doesn't have to be particularly thick. You know, it's fairly thin. And I'm not using a floorboard, but here's a piece of indentated cardboard, if you like. It's rather corrugated. Like corrugated of a way, but it's a more even pattern. In Ernst's case, of course, he would have laid this on the floor of his bedroom. He would have then got hold of a piece of crayon, and he would have started rubbing. You see, already a pattern's coming through. The indentation is showing like that. So if he was getting that sort of effect, it didn't tell him very much. But then he realized that there were other possibilities here. Anything that could be put underneath, by taking it away from the floorboard, and, say, introducing a French curve. These are plastic curves. So, you possibly put one of those underneath, and, again, you rub. Now, immediately you've got something. He's got a bird image.
Now, this is a slightly later painting. It's 1927, and it's called The Bird in the Forest. And his father used to take him into the forest sometimes and used to experience a kind of terror and ecstasy equally. And so the forest has become a very important element in his imagery. Now, compared with the earlier pictures we looked at, this is very richly painted. But don't believe it was done because Ernst had instantly acquired enormous skill. What he had acquired was terrific ingenuity in producing the effects of skill, in this case by pressing various objects onto the paint so as to produce a rich texture, or painting dark paint over light paint and then scratching through to produce the effects of luminosity and light. And the bird itself is in a little cage, which is in itself an odd idea, a caged bird in a forest. And its eye is made up of a circle, which appears to be pierced right through to the sky, because it's the same colour as the sky above the forest. And I think one has a certain awe, a certain pleasurable shiver in front of these pictures, because one appears to be in a great German forest and lost. In other words, perhaps inside Ernst's mind and lost. But birds for Ernst were a very central preoccupation. They frequently appear in his pictures, sometimes menacing, sometimes placatory. The reason for this was probably that when he was a very small child, he went into the garden one morning and discovered that a much beloved parrot had died, and at that very moment, a domestic ran out of the house to say his mother had given birth to a baby sister, and from then on he always claimed it to find it at times difficult to distinguish between human beings and birds.
There was certainly an obsessional thing about him, and of course if you look at him, he looks rather like a bird. He's got that beak of a bird and those eyes of his, you know.
His bird-like features aside, Ernst's obsession with birds and forests link his art to an earlier creative tradition, artistic, literary, philosophical, and essentially Germanic. Writer and art dealer Wolfgang Fischer.
If you take, for instance, a painting which is called La Forêt Effermée of 1927, you see a kind of almost dreamlike image of a form which is not exactly, deliberately not defined. Is it a wall? Is it a wood? Is it part of a house or a castle? It could be any image of these three, and it's up to you as a viewer to make your conclusion. And within this form, you see two little birds, almost like messengers of the Blaue Blume der Romantik, which was an image of the German Romantic iconography, the blue flower of Romanticism, some kind of very lyrical image in the middle. And putting all this together, it's an image which comes out directly from a subconscious, dream-like interpretation of the world. And that's the connection between Ernst, or surrealism at large, and German Romanticism.
Do you think there's any of that yearning or sentimentality or nostalgia that sometimes bedecks Romanticism?
Yes, it is, but happily enough, it's always saved, in the case of Ernst, by his wit and by his irony.
And a rather sinister sense of humour, which may in part help us to understand a mysterious and rather absurd creature called Lop Lop.
This is one of those pictures painted in the early 30s, which have as a subject a mysterious creature called Lop Lop, who was Ernst's familiar in a way. Lop Lop was the king of the birds, and as we know, Ernst was obsessed with birds. And Lop Lop, who took many forms, used to come and visit Ernst and give him gifts. Sometimes he would give him a young girl, sometimes he would give him an ornate Victorian diploma. On this occasion, he's giving a picture of himself. It's very, very beautiful in colour, this particular oil. It consists of a longish canvas with this human-handed, many-limbed creature with a cock's head, Lop Lop himself, and some of the hands are supporting a gold-framed picture of Lop Lop in a rather different form. Ernst uses all his tricks of texture, and the paint flares and glows and glitters, and the effect is very haunting.
Haunting, too, was the rise of fascism in Europe in the 30s. Ernst, like most of the other surrealist artists, had never engaged explicitly with politics in his art. But towards the end of the decade, he lashed out, in visual terms, at the renewed threat of war.
The Angel of Hearth and Home is an almost unique picture in Ernst's oeuvre. It is extraordinarily ugly. It shows an enormous figure with a hideous howling face advancing on us to gallop across an endless muddy plain. One of the arms of the figure has a strange insectoid-like growth sprouting from it, and the creature is dressed in vivid rags. And I think that this is a quite conscious reaction, painted as it was in 1937, to the Spanish Civil War, and the knowledge that that could only lead to another war. And it is a true scream of rage and horror and pain and everything. Very, very powerful, unpleasant to look at, but nonetheless one of the great indictments of fascism in any form, on a level indeed with Picasso's Guernica and the Premonition of Civil War by Salvador Dali. It's a great statement against brutality and stupidity.
When war eventually did break out, Ernst was interned in France as an enemy alien. But before he finally escaped and fled to America, he began to experiment with another new technique, that of decalcomania.
The usual method of decalcomania is that you wet your surface of paper, preferably a shiny surface. You then spread paint over it, in different colours if you like, and dot it and so on. Then you lie another piece of paper on top of it and peel it off. If you feel it's getting the right effect, you put it back and press it again. Then you peel it off and you get a marvellous background effect.
And then, of course, you amend.
Then you start cutting, painting out what you don't want, defining it, you see. Seeing images which are probably not there at first, but you see them. His great work, I think, in the use of decalcomania comes in about the 40s.
This picture, which is called Europe After the Rain, is a brilliant example of how Ernst could take a mechanical process, as he often did, and then trick it into looking extraordinarily brilliantly painted and extraordinarily realistic and three-dimensional. Against a watery sky, Ernst has isolated certain elements of decalcomania, of this pressing technique, and teased out of them all sorts of things. A woman in a hat walking towards the horizon, a Roman soldier with a bird's head, a ruined monument of some kind of bull, and the wreck of buildings standing amidst this rocky landscape. And by painting, for instance, patches of sky here or there in the decalcomaniac buildings, you see, he gives them a three-dimensional effect because you appear to see the sky through them. It's extraordinarily accomplished. And again, painted as it was in 1940 to 1942, it was actually partially painted while Ernst was on the run from the advancing Germans. Painted as it then was, it reflects pretty well the terrible devastation of Europe that was soon to become a reality after all the bombing and fighting was over.
Having reached America in 1941, Ernst remained there for 12 years before returning to France. His first few years in the States, spent in New York, were filled with anguish from his enforced exile. But in 1946, Ernst moved to Arizona with the young American painter Dorothea Tanning. After a life riddled with broken marriages and brief, though celebrated, affairs with a succession of beautiful women, he finally found emotional fulfilment and remained with Dorothea for the rest of his life until his death in 1976. But whether or not his art was fulfilled in his later years is less clear. Certainly his output was both highly accomplished and prolific, and included sculpture which he'd begun to produce sporadically since the mid-30s. But how does the later work compare with his art of the interwar years? Dawn Addis.
There's no doubt that the early works are the most concentrated and original and striking. The later works, to a certain extent, are reworkings of the old themes. They're also very pessimistic works, much more directly pessimistic. I mean, they aren't sort of subversive and bubbling and witty and nihilistic like the Dadaist ones. I mean, they're quite grim.
But if the later work is essentially a rather pessimistic reworking of old themes, doesn't all this mean that Ernst's inventiveness and influence as an artist cease on his arrival in America? Well, not necessarily so, for it could be argued that American abstract painters like Jackson Pollock found inspiration from the work of Max Ernst.
While he was working in the States during the Second World War, he began experimenting with another form of, as it were, automatic technique that he'd invented. He pierced the bottom of a paint tin to make holes in it, and he then made a sort of mixture of rather kind of liquid paint, put this can suspended on the end of a string, and then swung it. The paint came out of the holes at the bottom and dripped on the canvases, making these marvellous sort of sweeping curves, which actually rather suggest planets in orbit and sort of something of that kind. And it's said that Pollock saw these paintings and was thereby inspired to produce his own drip paintings.
So, finally, to the billion-dollar question. Is Max Ernst a great artist, whatever that may mean?
Ah, the great artist question. Yes, I think he is a great artist. In a funny way, he builds his own category, though. In a sense, he's a great surrealist artist. Max Ernst's work is not just a matter of beautiful technique or beautiful painterly surfaces, although sometimes those things are there. He's great because some of the images that he produced are so memorable that they've almost become commonplaces of our way of looking at things.
What Ernst's work lacks, and what essentially the surrealists probably were to criticize in it, was that Max Ernst has a very systematic mind. And spontaneity isn't a thing you'd associate with Max Ernst.
He's one of the most intricate, complicated intellectual artists of this century, I think. And in many ways, a lot of his paintings are what one might call overdetermined in a Freudian sense, in that there are almost too many possible meanings you can read into them.
You cannot just look at Ernst and say, oh, great, I like these colours, or I like these images. You always have to be aware that in the case of Ernst, it's more than just a picture. It's also an idea, it's a poem, it's an essay. It's this kind of marriage between the image and the content, which I think is great.
To me, many of the later paintings of Ernst become, well, very accomplished, but without the meaning of his early work. He had begun to sell very well. He was married to a young wife that he was very much in love with. Things were much happier for him. And some meaning went out of it, some anguish. But this picture, which is called The Cry of the Gull, is late and is, for me, very beautiful and very sad in a way. And it has a simplicity which much of the later work didn't have. It had become very complicated. It consists simply of a white background, a greyish-white background, on which Ernst has painted a series of dabs of blue at the top and more white towards the bottom, so it looks like a kind of snowstorm against a sunny sky. There's a single line towards the bottom which defines a hill, I suppose, or a curving landscape. And in the middle of this snowstorm, in the middle of the picture towards the top, is a very, very simple shape, rather like the yin of yin and yang, I suppose, with an eye in the middle of it. It's a darker blue than the sky behind it, and it represents the cry of the gull. But for me, somehow, it also represents the departure of Max Ernst, the departure of this great poetic spirit who so enriched our century. And it has a kind of gentle anguish.